Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Girl Explorers, the untold story of the globe-trotting women who trekked, flew, and fought their way around the world, by Jane Zangline. Read by Kirsten Potter. From the days of the mythical Argonauts until relatively recent times, the business of discovery and exploration, whether legendary or real, inevitably featured an all-male cast. Women stayed at home, awaiting the adventurer's return, presumably stitching away on some interminable tapestry in the tradition of that stoic image of patient resignation, Penelope. But in the 20th century, the situation began to change. Women freed themselves from their Victorian upbringing to organize and lead expeditions of their own, asserting themselves as serious experts. While almost forgotten today, they were far from ignored in their time. With the passage of time, however, the names and contributions tended to sink from sight, their achievements questioned or minimized. The essence of this era found a voice in 1925 in the creation of the International Society of Woman Geographers by many of these brilliant women. They sought intellectual companionship in a period when their global assaults were still regarded as decided aberrations from the norm. The trailblazing adventures of these women remain unique, and their contributions deserve reinstatement in the history of American explorers. Elizabeth Fagg Olds. My shock lies in the fact that there's so much inspiration to be drawn from real-life history that I don't understand how, after so many years, there's still a lack of tales about daring, gutsy, even reckless women. Yes, reckless. Why not? Show them being reckless. I'm not suggesting that they're perfect. I'm suggesting that they're interesting and that cinemas and libraries everywhere are missing out on spellbinding characters and, more importantly, on their ability as characters to inspire in young girls the realization that life is for living, risks, mistakes, and adrenaline-inducing bravery included. Kaya Purchase. Author's Note. In 2016, after a 10-week trip traveling throughout China, relaxing in Thailand, and studying Balinese gamelan, the traditional music of Indonesia, I returned home inspired to write a book about explorers. My research turned up Blair Niles, a forward-thinking woman explorer. I was immediately taken aback by this woman. Blair was born on a Virginia plantation in 1880, surrounded by freed slaves. Nearly two decades earlier, her maternal grandfather, a Virginia congressman, had provoked the Confederacy into launching the Civil War against the Union. When Blair was a child, her mother started a mixed-race night school to educate Blair, her brothers, and the children of the household's former slaves. She did this to expose her children to diverse viewpoints at a time when the family could not afford to send them off to school. Because of her mother's influence, and in spite of her grandfather's reputation, Blair became an advocate for marginalized and oppressed people. Although Blair is remembered as the author of the first compassionate book about gay people in Harlem, Strange Brother, her books on the brutal treatment of prisoners in French Guiana, Condemned to Devil's Island, The Uprising of Slaves During the Haitian Revolution, Black Haiti, A Biography of Africa's Eldest Daughter, and The Mutiny of the Armistead Slave Ship, East by Day, have been forgotten. Also overlooked is Blair's role in founding the Society of Woman Geographers, an organization with more than 500 members worldwide that will soon celebrate its 100th anniversary. When I learned about the diverse group of women who were early members of the Society, I expanded my writing project to tell the story of the founding of the Society. I was not disappointed. The early members of the Society are every bit as interesting as Blair Niles. These women were not diverse in the restrictive sense that we sometimes use the word today to denote inclusion of people of color. Most of the early members were white. But they were diverse in other ways. Socioeconomic status, educational attainment, occupation, sexual orientation, marital status, ethnicity, and nationality. This eclectic group of woman geographers, explorers, artists, scientists, musicians, writers, and storytellers shared common interests, all of which originated from their love of travel and exploration. During World War I, they sailed to Europe to assist the Allies, long before the United States entered the war. They also shared horizons broadened by travel experiences that altered their perspectives. Blair Niles viewed travel as a spiritual journey with the object of studying the national soul. She wrote, "One of the results of much wandering is undoubtedly to develop in the wanderer as many standards of beauty as there are races." Travel inspired these women to celebrate differences and encourage homebodies to see the world through a different lens. Many of the early members of the New York branch of the Society found a common cause in celebrating the rich cultural heritage of indigenous people. In the 1920s and 1930s, a time when social scientists feared that the way of life of indigenous people would soon disappear, society members rushed to visit other countries so they could portray these civilizations before they vanished. Blair Niles focused on the Mayans and Incans. Tay Atta introduced the public to her Chickasaw heritage, and Margaret Mead concentrated on oceanic people. Perhaps most emblematic of this desire to preserve cultures was Malvina Hoffman, who sculpted images of more than 100 people of different races for a 1933 exhibit at the Chicago Field Museum. Like many members of the Society, Malvina portrayed marginalized people with respect and understanding, modeling an attitude of tolerance that she hoped others would adopt. Although readers might assume the Society fought for women's rights, this was not the case. The Society itself did not tackle issues of discrimination as its mission. Many members, however, marched for equal rights during the suffrage movement and were leaders in that struggle. Some members, such as aviator Amelia Earhart and mountaineer Annie Peck, claimed their victories on behalf of women. Other members, such as the Society's first president, Harriet Chalmers Adams, focused less on competition between the sexes. Harriet believed that women's perceptions of the world differed from men's and that both were essential to offer a more complete idea of what has been seen and to present a more satisfying viewpoint than a purely masculine one can do alone. Like Harriet, Blair believed in the Baha'i principle that the world of humanity has two wings, one is woman and the other man. Not until both wings are equally developed can the bird fly. The Baha'i faith, founded in Persia, Iran, in the mid-1800s, includes spiritual teachings about the oneness of humanity and gender equality. Later, geographer Margaret Edith Trussell would summarize the same thought. How can a discipline realize its full potential while walking on only one leg? Society member Mary Ritter Beard devoted most of her career as a historian to reminding the public that women's contributions, although often ignored, had been central to the advancement of the human race. The problem was not that women had failed to develop their wings, but rather that women's achievements often went unrecorded or were overlooked. Her motto was, "No documents, no history." Mary dedicated much of her career to restoring woman's place in history. The Society's founders embraced this concept and required each prospective member to demonstrate not only that she had contributed to the world's store of knowledge about a specific geographical region, but that she had recorded this knowledge in writing, on phonographs or film, or through art, music, or dance. The Girl Explorers resurrects the history of many of the early Society members, women whose contributions to humanity have been forgotten. The story of this group of women gives us hope in an era when Americans have become more divisive and less tolerant. It reminds us that if we are to soar to great heights as a nation, we must find strength in our differences. Prologue. Band. In exploration, more, I think, than in any other career, a woman's success is dependent upon her determination not to be discouraged or deflected from the path of her chosen ambition. Blair Niles, author and society member. February 6, 1932, American Museum of Natural History, Manhattan. On a brisk winter evening in 1932, Blair Niles stood in the American Museum of Natural History, where the New York City branch of the Society of Woman Geographers was holding its first formal dinner. Blair and her friends had founded the society 7 years earlier as a sanctuary for women explorers after the Explorers Club refused to lift its ban on women members. Blair was now 52. Although she grew up on an isolated plantation in Virginia, she had become a world traveler. She had hiked through the Himalayas and journeyed down the Yangtze River as Chinese citizens rioted on the shore. With her southern drawl, she had negotiated with the chief of a Bornean tribe of headhunters, and, with the limited knowledge she had gained in an emergency medicine class, she had nursed the expedition's cook through moon madness. She had traveled through Malaysia by houseboat, ridden a camel through an Egyptian sandstorm, lived among convicts on Devil's Island off the coast of French Guiana, and witnessed voodoo ceremonies in Haiti. But thanks to Roy Chapman Andrews, she still couldn't get through the front door of the prestigious all-male Explorers Club. Roy Chapman Andrews was the president of the Explorers Club. He had cultivated an image as a rugged adventurer who traveled across the desert in vintage automobiles or caravans of camels. He claimed that, during his 15 years of exploration, he had escaped near death 10 times. Blair was always suspicious of near-death claims. They made good headlines, but they tended to be tall tales. She believed that, to a Munchausen, a foreign itinerary offers limitless temptations to exaggerate. Blair knew that the evening's program would be nothing short of spectacular, and so she invited reporters to cover the event. The program featured women with remarkable experiences. It also showcased a letter from Andrews who, to no one's surprise, had declined the Society's invitation to explain his recent contentious remarks at Barnard College, Columbia University's College for Women. Blair could not wait to hear the members' reactions when they heard that Andrews had told the assembled students, "Women are not adapted to exploration." Blair interpreted this to mean that it was acceptable for a woman to accompany her husband on an expedition or to organize a trek with other women as long as she did not upstage the men or challenge their masculinity. As one member of the Explorers Club explained, "The secret's out. One can live comfortably in the African jungle. We could formally come back and tell our lady friends almost anything about our perilous adventures and fights with tigers and boa constrictors. Now, we can't get away with it." Women explorers knew when men were stretching the truth. Andrews believed that, in many ways, women were equal to men. But they were not as strong as men, he thought, and their nervous systems were more sensitive. "With them, it is the drops of water that wear away the stone. The trivialities which men manage to ignore completely disturb them and prevent them from settling down to hard and concentrated work." Without a trace of irony, Andrews continued, "Take, for instance, a man who gurgles his soup. I have seen a man fly into a rage over such a simple thing as this, clench his hands at mealtime, turn to the offender and cry out, 'Great Scott, man, can't you eat your soup quietly?'" Blair must have wondered, did Andrews honestly believe that a woman cannot deal with the minor annoyance of a soup-slurping man on journeys fraught with danger? Newspapers throughout the country publicized Andrews's speech, and most editorials took the side of women. The New York Sun wrote, "When Roy Chapman Andrews told the Barnard girls recently that women had no place in exploration, he forgot to take into account the women who already had proved him wrong." The Newark Advocate in Ohio warned, "This is no time in the world's history to try to convince women that they cannot do anything a man can do." The Albuquerque Journal joked, "This should be evident to any man. If women want to go, they'll go." The Gazette of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, wrote, "Men excel women as explorers for the same reason that they excel in most other lines, simply because leaders of expeditions, like Mr. Andrews, have denied women the opportunities to prove themselves." In its first 7 years, the society had admitted more than 200 members in three branches. The largest group was in metropolitan New York, followed by the District of Columbia and Chicago. The remaining active members were scattered throughout the United States and Canada. Members held informal meetings almost monthly, usually at a member's home. The society had also admitted 37 corresponding members from countries as remote as the Union of South Africa and Cambodia. Blair watched as 30 members of the society's New York branch roamed the museum's Hall of Birds of the World in their brilliantly colored silk, velvet, and crepe gowns. She was pleased with the turnout. Nearly 70% of the New York branch had attended, a remarkable achievement for a group of women who spent much of their time abroad. The adventurers conversed in small groups, sharing knowledge, experiences, and contacts. Blair was honored to be among these strong, independent, and fierce women who climbed mountains, explored jungles, descended into the depths of the ocean, and studied Aborigines. They opened doors to other worlds for their sister explorers. Although Blair did not know it, one of the evening speakers would unwittingly find a sponsor for her upcoming trip to Peru. She ushered a reporter over to interview the society's oldest member, Annie Peck, who was sitting at a table trying not to wince. Annie had recently broken three ribs in a streetcar accident, and her abdomen was bound tightly in bandages under her evening gown. Blair admired the spunk of the 81-year-old mountaineer, who was an expert in Latin America. Born into the Victorian age in 1850, she flamboyantly defied expectations that women be firmly harnessed to domesticity. New Jersey's Monmouth Democrat later reported that Annie had attended the society's dinner 2 days after she got out of the hospital. The reporter noted, "The same spirit that took her to the tip of lofty peaks took her to that dinner. If I was awarding a medal for gameness, it would go to Miss Annie Smith Peck." Afterward, Blair arranged for a photographer to take a picture of the prominent explorers at the dinner. She gathered the evening's three speakers, aviator Amelia Earhart, zoologist Gloria Hollister, and explorer Elizabeth Dickey. She located Grace Barstow Murphy, the society's rare example of an explorer who brought her three young children on her naturalist husband's expeditions. Grace firmly believed that her sons would become better men because she answered the call of adventure, even though she was deaf. Blair also rounded up Osa Johnson, who was famous for her wildlife adventure films. Osa was a stormy, temperamental woman who had captivated the hearts of Americans when, at age 20, she looked like a cute 15-year-old, she starred in her husband's silent movies. The moving pictures, which featured adorable, pale Osa with the indigenous dark-skinned people of Oceania, were, in part, stellar ethnographic films and, in part, racist vaudeville shows. Blair may have wondered whether Osa was a shining example of a woman geographer. The dinner bell rang, and Blair sat at the head table. The program was about to begin. The society's youngest member, Gloria Hollister, age 31, rose to speak. She had a master's degree in zoology from Columbia and was an expert on fish coloration. Gloria had adopted a revolutionary technique that made fish transparent so that she could observe their bone structure without the need for dissection. She described the process. "Like the fading of one cinema picture and the gradual appearance of another, the skin and flesh of the fish become less and less opaque before our eyes, while the skeleton, stained a brilliant scarlet, crystallizes into plain view." The Bermudans she worked with called it fish magic. Blair could feel the excitement in the room as Gloria described her dive 410 feet below the ocean in a bathysphere, a metal diving globe lowered into the water by a cable. During the descent, she was connected to land by a telephone line. "But for the telephone communication, I might have been an isolated planet swinging in mid-ether." She told the audience how the fish bumped against the bathysphere's small porthole. "This has opened up a whole new world for scientific investigation." She was proud to be the only girl who has adventured into the ocean. The audience applauded. Despite this remarkable presentation, a Minneapolis Star journalist who covered the formal event reported later that Gloria looked more like one of Ziegfeld's glories than a scientist. Blair would not have been surprised. She knew that it was nearly impossible for men to see genius when beauty is staring them down. But this was nothing new. Advertisements for Gloria's lecture series noted, "She looks like a musical comedy star, but she has one of the finest scientific minds ever found in a woman." The Family Circle published an article about Hollister under the banner, "Gloria, the beautiful ichthyologist," or "Some blondes have brains." This type of publicity was precisely what Blair tried to avoid. But Blair was a legend at working with the media and knew that copywriters liked to emphasize the sensational because it sold more papers. Gloria was one of the many young women assisting Blair's ex-husband, William Beebe, in his deep-sea explorations for the Department of Tropical Research at the New York Zoological Park, now the Bronx Zoo. Newspapers often pictured her wearing a bathing suit as she prepared to descend into the ocean. Will Beebe was known for giving incredible opportunities to young women scientists and artists. Those opportunities sometimes included sexual liaisons. Blair was pretty sure that Will, whose new wife had agreed on an open marriage, was having an affair with Gloria at his Bermuda research site. Blair, who had grown up in the Victorian era with its puritanical morals, believed that her generation had simultaneously degraded sex and made a fetish out of it. She thought that the younger generation of flappers, like Gloria, who were trying to live life to the fullest, were bound to make mistakes and ruin their lives with this sexual freedom. But she also believed that puritanical taboos had ruined many lives. As long as they were not injuring anyone, Blair believed that human beings should be as free as birds. Blair did not resent the women who worked with her ex-husband, but instead welcomed them into the society. Next, South American explorer Elizabeth Dickey rose to address the audience. She wore a pale blue evening gown. Dazzling earrings peeked from under her coiffed hair. She told the audience that during her honeymoon in Ecuador, she met headhunters who shrink the heads of their dead enemies so they can keep them as trophies. "Here's one," she said as she pulled it out of a box. "This is a particularly beautiful specimen." As she held the head high, long black hair dangled from its sides. Two ribbons made of iridescent beetle wings nestled against its hair. Absent-mindedly, Elizabeth stroked the head as she explained why the man had been killed. "The Jivaro headhunters have a peculiar way of making love, if I may call it that. They do not marry their own women, but steal their wives from neighboring tribes. When there is a shortage of wives, they go to war for their mates. But general warfare is uncommon, since their chief concern in life is to learn to steal women with skill and precision." Elizabeth spoke of the day that she and her husband, Herbert Spencer Dickey, arrived at the Jivaro Indian village. Engwa Ashi, a member of another tribe, had just stolen the chief's wife. The clan was in an uproar. The leader dispatched the warriors to retrieve his wife and to kill the kidnapper. One of the Jivaro warriors, Chunga, killed Engwa Ashi and returned with the abductor's head. But on the way back, a poisonous snake bit the hero. Elizabeth's husband treated Chunga and watched over him as he slowly recovered. The villagers were astounded that Chunga did not die. As Elizabeth talked, her earrings shimmered in the light. She told the audience the rest of the story with relish. "At once they looked upon us as supernatural." As a result of Chunga's bravery, the chief ordered the head of Engwa Ashi to be shrunken and given to Chunga to hang on his belt as a totem. The villagers set to work embalming the head. Elizabeth described the process. "The body of the victim is allowed to remain untouched for several days. Then an incision is made across the chest and another across the back. They meet above the shoulders. The skin is then pulled over the neck and skull. The result of this process is to reverse it, but before further treatment, it is returned to its natural position." The skin was soaked in a tan bark solution, then filled with hot sand and clay. 10 days later, the head was removed from the solution and emptied of sand. Next, they combed its hair and adorned the head. Gaudy feathers are hung from the ears, the nostrils are delicately stuffed, and the mouth is tightly sewn to keep the bad spirits inside. After the chief presented the head to Chunga, the hero gave it to Herbert to thank him for saving his life. Elizabeth regarded it as their honeymoon present. Amelia Earhart, a new member of the society, spoke next. She was preparing for a solo transatlantic flight, which she planned to coincide with the 5th anniversary of Charles Lindbergh's transatlantic flight. She glanced over at Annie Peck. At Blair's request, Amelia had recently endorsed Annie's book, Flying Over South America, which chronicled her 20,000 miles of flights over South America at age 80. Earhart wrote, "When I plan my trip southward, I shall use Flying Over South America as a reference. Perhaps I shall even take a copy with me in the cockpit to remind me that I am only following in the footsteps of one who pioneered when it was brave enough just to put on the bloomers necessary for mountain climbing." Amelia told the audience that, unlike Annie, who climbed mountains, she simply buzzed over them in her plane. The crowd stirred as Ruth Crosby Noble, the chair of the Society's New York branch, stood to read Roy Chapman Andrews's letter. She reminded the audience that Andrews recently told Barnard College's all-female student body that they did not have the physique to be good explorers. Andrews complained that, after he announced his expedition to the Gobi Desert, he received a letter from a woman who desired to become the expedition's field secretary. She wanted to create a welcoming environment for the explorers. Andrews sneered, "I am skeptical about the possibilities for a home atmosphere in a desert where sandstorms continue for weeks. I am equally unimpressed with ladies who put on riding breeches and plunge into jungles and deserts hunting live savages and dead fossils." Then he bragged about his accomplishments finding fossilized dinosaur eggs in the Gobi Desert. Noble read his letter aloud. "What I said was this, that on a big expedition, where the staff includes a half dozen or so men, I consider women to be a great detriment. They cannot do a technical job, in most cases, any better than a man, and their sex alone makes for complications. A leader has enough difficulties in running a big expedition without saddling himself with any that can be avoided. I also said that if a man and his wife wish to explore alone, or a woman wants to organize her own expedition, there is no reason why such arrangements could not give excellent results. But he would not mix women and men on an expedition. It was asking for trouble." The audience erupted in an incredulous buzz. Andrews concluded, "I know of no more effective way to wreck an expedition than to put in one woman, or worse still, two." In support, he cited the Chinese character for trouble, which is a roof with two women under it. "One woman in an expedition is bad enough," he said. "Two are impossible." It would not take long for members of the society to prove him wrong. Members would set records as they climbed higher, flew faster, and dove deeper than men. But these women were not motivated by a desire to beat men's records, for they knew that they were capable explorers. Nor did they find a need to confine their travels to expeditions approved by men or to seek male approval. As deep-sea diver Sylvia Earle, one of the more famous members of the society alive today, explained, "Sometimes people find it hard to take us seriously, but most of the problems are in the minds of the men." Several members of the society would struggle to reorient the focus of history to include women by establishing archives so that women would not be ignored. For, as society member Mary Ritter Beard cautioned, "Without documents, no history. Without history, no memory." Part 1. Mere Women. Chapter 1. Reckless. Is it reckless? Maybe. But what do dreams know of boundaries? Amelia Earhart, aviator and society member. 1932, Manhattan. Blair was fond of referring to egotistical, domineering male explorers as the "we white men, red blood in your veins" variety of explorers. Male explorers who exploited opportunities in colonized lands by leading scientific expeditions, thus proving their courage, strength, and superiority by recounting.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?